For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right, we're finally at this last section of Luke's gospel, which is really the last week of Christ's life. And it is all about the experiences in and around Jerusalem on what is sometimes referred to as Passion Week. And it begins with this, what I'm calling ironic, triumphal entry into Jerusalem. And let's just pick up the text. He says in verse 28, this is Luke 19, Jesus headed to Jerusalem, walking ahead of his disciples. And when he approached Bethpage and Bethany near the mount called Olivet, he sent two of his disciples saying, go into the village. As you enter, you will find a colt tied on which no one has yet ever sat. Untie it and bring it to me. If anyone asks, why are you untying it? Say, the Lord has need of it. So those who were sent went and found it just as Jesus had told them. As they were untying the colt, its owners said to them, why are you untying the colt? And they said, the Lord has need of it. Okay. The disciples then brought the colt to Jesus. They threw their coats on it and put Jesus on it. And as he was going, they were spreading coats along the road. And as soon as he approached the descent of the Mount of Olives, the whole crowd of the disciples began to praise God joyfully with a loud voice for all the miracles that they had seen, shouting, blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord, peace in heaven and glory in the highest. And so this is a very odd scene for two reasons. It's just full of irony. The first irony has to do with really what Jesus is imitating here as he gets on this colt, the foal of a donkey. It's, I don't know if you've ever been on a donkey before. How many people have been on a donkey? Did like the Grand Canyon thing or whatever, a couple of you have. So imagine a baby one of those. It'd be almost like riding your dog, you know, it's not a big thing. And so the scene itself looks kind of strange, but it is what is referred to as a parousia, which in the Roman Empire, it's a victory march. And so the general has been out waging war and he's, you know, slaughtering this population and taking home slaves and booty of different kinds. And as he aligns his parade with all of the things that have been taken in conquest and the slaves and the victorious army, that's what is called a parousia. And it's a moment of recognition that Rome is still in its greatness, as is evidenced by the conquering hero who has come to receive his laurel wreath and his acclamation and all the things that just make for victory. And it's just this incredible thing. He's on the stallion or in a chariot or whatever it is, and the crowds are screaming his praises. And here in this scene, it's a donkey. And we say to ourselves, well, what's up with the donkey? And why is it that Jesus would choose to ride into Jerusalem riding on the back of a baby donkey? I mean, what is he trying to say? What's the point? It seems like it's very deliberate, doesn't it? Because there's all this planning that comes ahead of time. And indeed it is for a reason, and this reason is because Jesus is understanding the extraordinary nature of this event, the crescendo of his entire ministry is coming right into focus. And what better way to express that than the parousia of the victorious conquering king? Blessed is he, is the king who comes in the name of the Lord. The people are quoting Psalm 118, which is a psalm about God's Messiah. But there's a reason he chooses the colt, and that is because Zechariah chapter 9, verse 9, some 500 years before the time of Christ, says, "Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout in triumph, O daughter of Jerusalem. Your king is coming to you, and he is just and endowed with salvation, humble and mounted on a donkey, even the colt, the foal of a donkey." What is Jesus here doing? He's saying, don't lose the moment. Let's understand exactly what's going on here. He rides into the city, and the disciples are putting their coats on the ground before him to acknowledge his greatness, that he is in fact the King Messiah. And Jesus is wanting to bring their attention. This is not just my idea. This is God's idea. God predicted this very moment hundreds of years ago. I am the king. That's right. And I'm coming to you in humility, offering you not the spoils of victory, but salvation. And so it's a very carefully orchestrated event. The crowds are receiving Jesus as a victorious king like they had never done before. If you've been with us in our study of Luke, it's been a little ironic that the people who are really recognizing who Jesus is, Jesus the son of David, the king, are people like demoniacs or non-Jewish people or people that they would consider outcasts for various kinds of sins that they were committing. And yet they are the people who are responsive of heart, as we talked about last week, and who recognize Jesus for what he truly was. His own disciples were kind of confused on this point, but not at this point. Now there's a moment of clarity. Now they realize that the pieces are coming together, and so the roadway is lined with his disciples as he's moving toward the great city to enter into the city. They cry out, "Hosanna, blessed is he who comes, the king who comes in the name of the Lord." So this is an incredible moment. And yet, how ironic, how in contrast that is to a Roman parousia, which is a showcase of Roman power and greatness. He comes in humility. And think, too, about this same crowd screaming the praises of Jesus this Sunday, only several days later, to scream out as well, "Crucify, crucify, give us Barabbas." What strange irony this must be, and in the mind of Christ, who knows all things and knew what laid before him, as he told his own disciples, the Son of Man is going to Jerusalem to be handed over and will be scourged and beaten and crucified, but on the third day raised from the dead. Christ knew what was going on. And so there is this ambivalence in his own heart, this incredible moment where on the one hand, yes, it's finally, people are seeing that the him for who he is, and for the first time has been willing to accept a public recognition of his identity as the Messianic King. But knowing at the same time how this week is going to end. Very strange. And so it's with that in mind then we move on. Verse 39, some of the Pharisees in the crowd say to Jesus, "Teacher, rebuke your disciples." Why rebuke them? Because how could you possibly be God's Messiah? How could you be the king? Because after all, you are just the son of that woman, and you hang out with the wrong crowd, and you offend us in various ways, and so you couldn't possibly be our king. But Jesus, instead of arguing with them, simply says, "I tell you, if these become silent, the stones will cry out." And when he approached Jerusalem, he saw the city, and he wept over it, saying, "If you had known in this day the things which make for peace, but now they have been hidden from your eyes. For the days will come upon you when your enemies will throw up a barricade against you and surround you and hem you in on every side, and they will level you to the ground and your children within you, and they will not leave on you one stone upon another because you did not recognize the day of your visitation. So here's the second irony, and which is what Jesus has to say is not your typical victory speech. It's not what the conquering hero who returns to his home has to say. He doesn't say, "Hail Caesar," and, "Rome rocks," and whatever. Instead, he denounces the city. He casts a lament over the city, and he says that there is a time that is coming when your enemies are going to throw a barricade up against you. In other words, they're going to lay Jerusalem to siege. And siege warfare in the ancient world was no pretty picture. And Jerusalem had been laid siege before in 586 BC. And it's basically a strangulation tactic. They just cut off every resource and people are starving to death. They're dying of exposure. And finally, when they're ready to say it's better for us to die at the sword of our enemy than to eat our children, they open the gates and the invading army comes in and just destroys everything that is there. And this audience that Jesus was referring to knew exactly what that was about. But it's very interesting that Jesus would have this to say at this moment. Because he's predicting something very specific, isn't he? There's no ambiguity about this language at all. Jesus is here speaking in 33 AD of an event that occurs in 70 AD when Titus, the Roman general, to put down a Jewish rebellion, enters into the city of Jerusalem after laying it to siege and destroys the city and destroys the temple. And Jesus is saying that is exactly where things are going. And so many of you who are here this day and singing the praises of God's Messiah in total ignorance, knowing that I'm not the Messiah you seek, are going to behold yourselves the destruction of the great city and all that comes with that. And so for Jesus, this is an incredibly powerful moment. On the one hand, a prophetic recognition of who he is. On the other, the sorrow and the sadness in Jesus' understanding of what lays ahead for these very people. And then very curiously, and this is where we're going to spend our time, he talks about the destruction of the great city in connection with, or a reason given for it. He says, you didn't recognize the time of your visitation. There's that word in the Greek, parousia. You didn't recognize when your king had truly come. That's what he's saying, because he knows he's going to be rejected by week's end. And that with that, all of the calamity that God, hundreds of years earlier, knew would take place. And so here is where we want to launch out tonight into a bit of a study. We want to seize on this expression, you did not recognize the time of your visitation. What is he talking about here? Well, what he's talking about is a perspective on the Old Testament. The question that dominates the Old Testament as it draws to a close is, when will all of the great predictions in the Old Testament from the prophets and even all the way back into the law of Moses itself about the anointed one, the Messiah that God is going to send into the world to deal definitively and permanently with the problem of humankind and human existence. The problem, namely, of our separation, our alienation from God. When, how, where, who, what, how is this going to get resolved? And the Old Testament describes in detail scores of events that relate to the life of Christ. We've seen just one of them already here this evening. Zechariah chapter 9, verse 9, where the Messiah enters into the city of Jerusalem on a baby donkey. Well, you say to yourself, well, Jesus, as a good student of the Old Testament, could surely have read that and thought, well, this fits in well with my narrative of my claim to be Messiah, so I'm just going to find myself a baby donkey and say, hey, see, I'm the Messiah. Well, I suppose that would be possible, but then there are also questions like, where did the Messiah come from? Where was he born? That Jesus wouldn't have a whole lot of control over that. And yet Micah chapter 5 verse 2 makes it clear that it's Bethlehem, the city of David, is where the Messiah is going to come from. And of course, that's exactly where Jesus is from. We know that who he is. He is a son of David. Ultimately, he's in the Davidic kingly line. We know what he has come to do, namely to die for the sins of humanity. And why? Because we're alienated from God. And how that's going to occur, all of that is written in great detail in the pages of the Old Testament. We're going to see over this next several weeks of our study, as we close in on the grand finale of Luke's gospel, we're going to see how dozens of Old Testament passages begin to just tumble into place as Jesus' ministry really comes to its moment, its completion, that exodus that he said he would complete in Jerusalem. But when Jesus says to the crowd, the city is going to be destroyed, and the reason for that is because you did not recognize the time of your visitation, he is pointing to a prophecy that relates to something that was absolutely outside of his control, right? Namely, when God would send his Messiah into the world. And so what I would like to do here this evening is to go back in history, to go back in time to the prophet Daniel, who's writing in the 400s BC, or late 500s BC. And he is writing inspired prophetic words from God that don't describe nearly what the Messiah is going to do when he comes, although there's certainly that, but in exactly when. And I want us to think this through together, because what if that's accurate? What if that's true? Well, then we would certainly have something very amazing on our hands. We know, without any doubt, even the most skeptical historian concedes, the book of Daniel was written hundreds of years before the time of Christ. We know that because we actually have physical copies from the Dead Sea Scrolls. There are 8 sections of the book of Daniel that are a part of the Dead Sea Scrolls that are datable to between 150 and 200 BC. We know that Daniel is part of the Old Testament called the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible that was done in 200 BC. The centuries before Christ dating of Daniel is not, I repeat, not a matter of serious question. So the question is then, to what level of specificity does Daniel predict the coming of God's Messiah? And that brings us to Daniel chapter 9. We want to look starting in verse 24. He says, a period of 70 sevens, literally in Hebrew, it's Sabbaths. 70 sevens, he says, has been decreed for your people, that is the Jewish people, and your holy city to finish the rebellion, to put an end to sin, to atone for guilt, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to confirm the prophetic vision, and to anoint the most holy place. So what is Daniel, what does his prophecy deal with? It deals with this bringing to an end this battle that has existed from the very beginning between God and humanity created in his image, who is in revolt against God, to finish the rebellion. God has given us free will. And he's saying, you know, love, which is what I seek, is a love relationship from the creatures I've made in my image. But the capacity to love is really rooted in your ability to choose. You can't make someone love you, right? God didn't create a bunch of Stepford wives or whatever. He created free choosing agents. With that comes the capacity to defy him, which of course is what we have done. But we may be free to rebel against God, but we're not free with respect to its consequence. And to rebel against God is to become guilty before him, to violate his design for our lives as a creature before a benevolent creator brings us into a guilt position with respect to God. We've disobeyed him. Any parent understands what that is. But God's Messiah is coming to atone for guilt, it says, to deal with the problem of what we owe God. And when God said to Adam in the garden, on the day that you eat of this fruit, you shall surely die. The reality is we've been living in a state of spiritual death and face the reality of physical death as well. And so God had set it up in the Old Testament that that's not the way I want people to end up. But they can't make themselves alive if they're dead. They can't make themselves innocent if they're guilty. And so here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to provide a substitute for them, a sacrifice on their behalf. One who dies the death that they deserve. So that in the righteous action of this substitute, he can offer them the forgiveness that comes through his having paid their debt. You see what I'm saying? That's what Daniel is talking about right here. So the question then is, what does it mean? A period of 70 sevens or Sabbaths has been decreed for your people for this incredible event to take place. So let's break that down just a little bit, because this isn't just some weird, you know, mumbo jumbo. What do you think it means? Oh, I don't know. I think it means this. What about you? Oh, I don't know. I kind of feel this way about it. The text interprets itself. The text interprets itself. Let's break this down just a little bit. Sabbath, again, means seven. And so a Sabbath day is the seventh day, right? We use that language even here in our modern world. Sabbath day. Saturday, not Sunday. But then in the Old Testament as well, there is a Sabbath year, which is the seventh year. And seven sevens then would be 490 either days or years. Do you see that? Seven sevens have been decreed. 70 times seven, 490 years or days have been decreed, in which time these events will take place. And so what is the context? What are we talking about here? Well, we're talking about, in Daniel's context, a Sabbath rest that God predicts, starting all the way back with Moses, for the land to enjoy its rest. And so we come to Leviticus chapter 25. This is written by Moses in 1500 BC. Daniel's writing closer to 500 BC. So there's a 1,000-year separation between these things. It says, when you come into the land that I will give you, this is Moses getting ready to send, you know, to the children of Israel are going to enter into the land, the promised land. He says, the land must have a Sabbath to the Lord. For 6 years you shall sow your field and gather its crop, but during the seventh year, the land must have its Sabbath. It's going to have to rest on that seventh year. So that's called the Sabbath year legislation. It's very important. In this time, on the seventh year, the land would lie fallow. No one would sow or harvest during that year. The years before, they could save up the grain that they needed to bring them through this seventh year. And also during this time, there was a forgiveness of debts and various things that really kind of kept things going in terms of people's ability to put God first in their life, to trust them with what was then the most important possession, which is their land. And the land needed its rest. You can over cultivate land. And God, of course, knew this. And he's like, the land needs its rest, just like people need their rest and everything else. And so there is this Sabbath year legislation. And there is a warning as well against violating the Sabbath year legislation. And that also comes from Leviticus chapter 26. He says, if you don't obey me, the land will enjoy its Sabbaths. Oh yeah, I will keep my law and the land's going to get its rest. It will enjoy its Sabbaths all the days of the desolation while you are in your enemy's land. This is Moses saying this 1,000 years before Nebuchadnezzar's Babylon destroyed Jerusalem. He says it will observe the rest it did not observe on your Sabbaths while you were living in it. So you see what we're saying here? There's a Sabbath year, and God is real serious about that Sabbath year being honored and obeyed, and yet knows that people being what they are, if there's a profit to be made, we're going to do that, and we're going to find some way of explaining or justifying what we do. And so they did. And so they didn't really observe the Sabbath legislation. And those 6 years went by, and that seventh year, they just continued right on with their cultivating and did not give the land its rest. But God didn't forget that. And so God took them into captivity into Babylon 1 year for every year they did not obey the Sabbath year. Jeremiah, the prophet, tells us this land, this whole land will be a desolation and a horror, and you will serve the king of Babylon 70 years. 70 years. 1 year for every year that you did not obey the Sabbath year law. You see what he's saying here? 70 years. What does that mean? That means that, as it says in the Chronicles, those who escaped the sword were carried away to Babylon. They lived as servants until the Persian rule. And this was to fulfill the word of the Lord through Jeremiah that the land would have its Sabbaths for 70 years. 70 years. And so Daniel says at the beginning of this chapter that we're looking at, in the first year of Darius's reign, he's the Persian king, I, Daniel, observed in the books the number of years which was revealed as the word of the Lord to Jeremiah the prophet for the completion of the desolation of Jerusalem, namely 70 years. 70 years. If a Sabbath year is every 7 years and Israel was exiled for 70 years for violating this law, how many years did Israel fail to practice the Sabbath year legislation? Who's got an idea? Did you bring your thinking cap? 1 year for every Sabbath year that they miss. Sabbath year comes along every 7 years. What do? You multiply, right? 7 times 70. And what does that give you? 490 years. And this is exactly the situation then that Daniel was contemplating. That 70 years is close to coming to its completion. What's going to happen next? And this is when God then begins to speak to him about the coming of the Messiah. So you have 490 years before the captivity in Babylon, in which Israel did not obey the Sabbath year legislation, which means literally almost its entire history. So it's a pretty bad track record. Okay. Then there's the 70 years of captivity. And now in this prophecy in Daniel chapter 9, God is saying, I've got another 70 Sabbaths, 490 years to anticipate in the future, which will bring to completion my plan for humanity. Do you see the symmetry of the thing? It's very intended. I've cited here Dr. Samuel Sandmel, who is a professor of Hebrew scriptures at Hebrew Union University, actually down in Cincinnati. He is not a Christian. He's not interested in Christianity, and he does not recognize Jesus as the Messiah. But I note in the New English Bible annotated version, he writes an extensive article on Daniel, and on page 959, he says, that's where I stole that outline from him. That's what it is. It's 490 years of failure, met with 70 years of captivity, and a promise of King Messiah 490 years into the future. That is the framework of this prophecy. Now in verse 25, it says, listen and understand. Seven sevens, okay, seven Sabbaths of years, right? plus 62 sevens will pass from the time the command is given to rebuild Jerusalem, which now is in rubble, until a ruler, the anointed one, that's the Hebrew for Messiah, comes. And Jerusalem will be rebuilt with streets and strong defenses despite the perilous times. So what is Daniel saying here? The anointed one is going to come after seven sevens and 62 sevens. That's 69 sevens, or 69 times 7 years. Seven Sabbath years, 62 Sabbath years, 483 years. That's literally what he's predicting. This is how this is interpreted by Jews and Christians alike. This framework is not disputable. Now, he tells us, what's the starting point? When do we know from when? When do we start the clock moving forward to the time of God's Messiah? He says, well, here's how you know. From the time of the command is given to rebuild Jerusalem until the Messiah. And by rebuilding, he means with streets and its defenses and everything else. So wouldn't it be good to know when the command was given to rebuild Jerusalem? Because then we could just put our formula that everyone agrees to, the 483 years, the seven Sabbaths of years, and the 62 Sabbaths of years. Then we'd have it. We would know when the anointed one comes. You follow? There's a PowerPoint there available to you at the bookstore also. We can follow up. Let's think about this. When does this time clock begin? Well, there's possibilities. There's an edict in 539 BC known well to history by Cyrus, which is an edict to rebuild the temple. But that's really not what it's describing there, is it, in Daniel chapter 9? It's about rebuilding the city, right? That's not it. Darius in 519 BC repeats, essentially, Cyrus's edict to rebuild the temple. But there again, that just doesn't fit the description. Artaxerxes in 457 BC assigns an edict allowing a migration of Jews to return to Jerusalem. But that's not what Daniel's describing at all. That's not rebuilding the city. Then we come to Nehemiah chapter 2, where Artaxerxes, the Persian king, in 444 BC, the 20th year of his reign, decrees an authorization to rebuild the city of Jerusalem. Artaxerxes, well known to historians. You can read about him in Wikipedia or Encyclopedia Britannica or any source at all. We're not talking about Christian sources here. He is well known to history. It's well established that in the spring of 464, he became the emperor, the king of the Persians, the Medo-Persians. And Nehemiah tells us in the 20th year of his reign, this decree was given. In the month of Nisan, that's in the spring of the 20th year of Artaxerxes, Nehemiah says, this is Nehemiah chapter 2, I said to the king, if it please the king, and if your servant has found your favor, send me to Judah, the city of my father's tombs, that I may rebuild it. Let letters be given for the governors of the provinces beyond the river, and a letter to Asaph, keeper of the king's forest, by timber to make beams for the gates of the fortress and the walls of the city. And the king granted this to me in the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes. So Nehemiah is very specific about the time. So here's our decree to the only one known to history. to rebuild Jerusalem, just as Daniel says, from the issuing forth of a decree to rebuild the city until Messiah comes, are seven sevens and 62 sevens. And now we have the only really plausible edict that he could be referring to in the spring of 444 BC. That means that if we have seven sevens and 62 sevens, that's 69 sevens, units of 7 years, to the coming of the Messiah, we could calculate from that exactly when Messiah is coming. But we can be very specific down to the very year if we do this one thing, which is to change the ancient lunar calendar of 360 days a year to the modern historical calendar of 365 days. You see, there's a difference there. In the ancient world, it was a lunar calendar. And so the year was only 360 days. And the way historians mark time is based upon a solar calendar. It's 365 days. So let's be really specific together. What's the difference? The difference is this. If we multiply the 483 years of this prophecy, the seven sevens and the 62 sevens, times the number of days in each of those prophetic years, those lunar years, you get 173,880 days. Do the math. And if you divide that number of days by 365, the number of days in modern historians' calendar year, you get 476 actual solar years that this prophecy from the beginning of this decree in 444 BC forward moving 476 years, where does that bring us? Well, it brings us to 32 AD. That's an interesting date. But there's more. If we're just simply going from over a number line where we have negative numbers representing BC and positive numbers representing AD, right? Number lines differ from calendars. Number lines have this thing called a zero, right? There's never been a year zero. The difference between 1 BC and 1 AD is 1 year. Whereas on a number line, the difference between minus 1 and plus 1 is what? It's 2, right? So to allow for this discrepancy, we add a year, which brings us to the spring of 33 AD. It's something to think about. Daniel says, after the period of 62 sevens, the anointed one will be killed, appearing to have accomplished nothing. And a ruler will arise whose armies will destroy the city and the temple. And the end will come with a flood, and war and its miseries are decreed from that time to the end. Why did Jesus weep over the city? Because they did not recognize the time of their visitation. Because after the time of the Messiah, the Anointed One's visitation, where he will come. Read it carefully. When he will come. When he will be killed. Where it will seem that he accomplished nothing. A ruler will arise whose army will destroy that city and its temple. And that happened in 70 AD by the Roman general Titus. And its end did come with a flood of misery and calamity, just as Jesus described. And Jesus is placing himself in the very framework of this incredible prophecy. He seemed like he didn't get anything done. He was rejected even by his own people. And yet, no, He did exactly what he came to do, which was to atone for the guilt of all of humanity, as the prophecy describes. And the Romans did come and destroy the city. This is a prophecy that has been fulfilled. And it is an amazing prophecy. So we go back to Luke 19 and we think about this with fresh eyes. When Jesus approached Jerusalem and he saw the city and he wept over it, he said, "If you had known this day, the things that make for peace, the days will come on you when your enemy will surround you and hem you in on every side, and they will level you to the ground and your children within you, and they will not leave one stone upon another because you did not recognize the time of your visitation." This is exactly what Jesus is referring to. Exactly what Jesus was referring to. That Daniel was predicting the very time that Messiah would arrive. The ancient Jewish interpreters, again, this is not a Christian interpretation of this text. The Jewish historian Josephus, who was born just a matter of a few years after Jesus' death and lived to about 100 AD, was a Pharisee himself, and he was a court historian of the Romans, charged with writing a history of the Jewish people. And so in his Antiquities of the Jews, in Book 10, Josephus discusses Daniel. And it says that we believe that Daniel conversed with God. For he not only predicted or prophesied of future events, as other prophets did, but he also determined the time of their completion. And he goes on to say in Jewish wars about the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD, Josephus says, their chief inducement to go to war, that is the Jewish people, to rise up against the Romans, was an oracle found in their sacred writings announcing that at that time a man from their country would come and be a world ruler, a Messiah, the prince. The Jews of the first century, in other words, were reading Daniel in just exactly the same way that we read Daniel, and concluded they did not know the 444 BC date of the edict to rebuild Jerusalem that began the prophetic clock moving toward its ultimate completion. They didn't have that. They just had a ballpark, a general idea of when that was, but they understood it in the same way. And so we ask at this stage of the game then, what conclusion can we draw from this study? And there are, I think, two that are really important. First, if not Jesus, then who? Right? Now, this discussion has been based upon an understanding of Sabbath years. This is not something that we've read into the text. We've not made this up. We understand Daniel's thought world when he wrote this prophecy. Why are we in exile in Babylon? Because for 490 years, 70 Sabbath years, we have violated God's law, and he has kept us here so that the land would have its rest. But God is merciful, and in his mercy, he says, just as you've blown it for 490 years, in 490 years, I'm going to bring you a blessing that is amazing. From the issuing of a decree to rebuild the city until the coming of the fulfillment of Old Testament prophecy, the time of its completion, when Messiah the Prince, as he says, comes, dies, atones for the sin of a broken and lost humanity, it is in that time frame. And why? Who else could fit this description? We'd simply have to say that, nice try, Daniel, but, it just didn't work out. Or we could say, that is pretty amazing. That's pretty amazing that we can objectively walk through the data of Scripture, as anyone can do, and arrive at a at the best date for the entrance of Jesus into Jerusalem and his crucifixion. There are only two possible dates for the fulfillment of this prophecy. One is 30 AD and the other is 33 AD. And the reason I say this is for two reasons. One is because it is an absolute hard fact of history that Jesus died, was crucified under Pontius Pilate. Not because the Bible says so, though it does, but because Roman historians such as Tacitus exactly say this thing, that Jesus died under the rule of Pilate as the governor of Judea, and that he died on Passover. And the only two Fridays in which there is a Passover during the reign of Pilate in Jerusalem and in Judea was 30 and 33 AD. So there are so many lines of evidence that put Jesus in history. He's not a mythological figure. Every historian who takes seriously the data of Jewish, Roman, and biblical history recognizes that Jesus is a true historic figure, that he did die just as the Bible describes. And we have this evidence to say both when and why. Why does God do that? Why does he do that? Because we have a need to really know, that's why. You know, the stakes are really high. If what the Bible says is true, everything is at stake here. Is it true that there's something fundamentally wrong with humanity in general and me in particular? That is not just I'm not well understood or I've got certain economic problems or whatever it might be, but something deeper than that. Something at the core of my being, a spiritual lostness, an alienation that penetrates down into my heart. I think we do sense that. We all sense that in our honest moments. And the Bible declares that this is what Jesus Christ came to deal with. And he wants you to know that he meant it. He wants you to know that this is not a fairy tale, some good idea, some myth that it pleases you to believe in because it makes you deal with your day or something like that. Now think about this. If all we had of Jesus was the miracles that he performed, I don't know about you, I'm kind of a skeptical guy. I'd say, well, that's real interesting, but I never seen anything like that, right? Or even if you were there to see them yourself, you might say, well, I did have mushrooms in my soup. And I wonder if maybe that's why I'm seeing the things that I'm seeing. You know, there could be all manner of plausible explanation for us. This is the one that is, we can't just walk away from. This says that nearly 500 years before, a little over the 500 years before the time of Christ, God raised up this guy, Daniel, who articulated with clarity a timetable in which God would send his Messiah into the world. And that timetable exactly corresponds to when the Bible and the broader historians that we can consult recognize that Jesus is entering into Jerusalem, uttering these very things that he said that were recorded in Luke chapter 19. And he did them because he recognizes you have a need to really know. To really know. Not to wishfully hope or think, but to really know that his love for you is boundless. When he said he loved the world so much that he gave his only begotten son, that he meant that, and that it's for you. And so you can have this objective record of what he intended to do well before the time, so that you can't attribute this to, well, Jesus just, you know, was looking at his watch and decided, hey, today's the day. You know, let me find a donkey and ride into Jerusalem. This is not a prophecy that he could just decide to fulfill. Okay, this is what God has breathed into the pages of history, and that Jesus is ultimately the person to whom these things are addressed. There's a several week series on the claims and case for Christ available at the bookstore and on our website, www.xenos.org. If you're here this evening and you're interested in these issues and you have not yet received the free book that we give to our guests about, I forget what it's called now, Dennis's book on Discovering God. Okay, it's gone through a few iterations. There's a chapter on this to go back to and read for yourself to think this thing through. Look, nothing could be more important than what we're describing right here. Take that time. Be convinced and understand the incredible love God has for you, that he would predict these things with such specificity so long before they came to pass.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.